Morning, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that comes through loud and clear. For those who know me, I think it's fair to say it's not my natural habitat to be here at 7:30 in the morning discussing this fascinating subject, as it is, of restrictive covenants. We had two extremely learned speakers who will discuss the two forums in which these sorts of issues are dealt with. The first of those is Tom Accuser, a member, of course, of Green's List. Tom's areas of practice are set out, and I note that he's one of the few that actually had said it before language is spoken. I'm not sure whether Tom's going to break into French this morning, but that's one element of his profile that I became aware of only by investigating the profile on the website. I discovered to my horror that somebody suggesting that I know something about banking and finance. There needs to be an update of the Martin's profile, Mr. Green, and that will be attended to in the next 24 hours. Tom, if we could call upon you to carry out the first paper. What we're planning to do is have the two speakers, who will of course address the two forums, VCAT and the court, and then hopefully we might be able to facilitate some discussion at the end of the two papers. So if I could call upon Tom Accuser to speak first, please.
Thanks very much, John. My wife asked me last night, so I've got a joke to start with, given that it's going to be 7:30 in the morning. She said, are there any charging cases in restrictive covenants? And I said, well, you know, they're all pretty boring, actually. And so with that, she said, oh, well, you have to think of something, I suppose. And she turned away and started watching MasterChef again. So I must say, even though they are sort of relatively boring, I really do quite enjoy doing them, because I find that with practice spanning property and planning law, as well as rebuilding, it's a great area to be involved in. I do have a paper that will be available at the end for you to collect, so you're just going to have to bear with me while we talk about the paper. My area is going to look at how you go about varying or removing a restrictive covenant or easement in the VCAT. And I'm just going to, rather than say easement and restrictive covenant the whole time, I'm just going to refer to it as a restriction. And before I get into it, there's a number of ways that VCAT has jurisdiction to hear disputes of this nature. Under the Subdivision Act, you've got the option of going into the real property or the owner's corporation, this VCAT. And generally speaking, you would do that if you were dealing with an easement that you wanted to vary or remove. And normally, in that circumstance, you'd go into the real property list. But if there was a subdivision involved which had an owner's corporation, generally speaking, they'll put you in the owner's corporation list. Now, that probably doesn't have great import, given that the members running both lists are pretty similar, but you know, strategically you might want to think about that before you decide which way you wanted to go. The other way, of course, that you can vary a restriction in VCAT is under the Planning and Environment Act, by way of an application for a planning permit to vary or amend a restriction. And I think this morning I want to just talk about the processes in that part of VCAT's jurisdiction, because that's predominantly where these kinds of applications are made. Now, there's no getting around the fact that any applicant has a pretty high test that they have to satisfy in order to certainly remove a restriction, a bit less so if you want to vary it. And the test ultimately is that you don't want to cause any detriment or perceived detriment to any affected parties, that's to say anybody with a beneficial interest in the restriction. It may be possible under the Act to characterise the an objector's objection as being vexatious, and the concept of vexatiousness is not one that's similar to what you would think of as being frivolous and vexatious. It's a bit different to that. alternately, you might be able to say that, well, actually, what I'm proposing to do under this planning permit is not going to be in breach of the restrictive covenant, and so therefore I should be able to do it, and you don't have to worry about the fact that I'm varying or restricting, varying or seeking to vary or remove this restriction. Now, despite the very high test that you've got to satisfy and the other pretty tight criteria that you've got to meet, VCAT does vary restrictions. I would probably say that it's a fairly potted history, and it does depend very much on the particular circumstances of the case. It's pretty rare, though, that a restriction will be removed in its entirety without the consent of all the beneficial parties. One other thing you need to remember, too, is that people often think that VCAT will give you a quick and cheap resolution of your problem. But one of the key things you've got to bear in mind, particularly if you're dealing in the planning area, is that the planning members have a very planning focus to their considerations. And when you start bringing in proprietary interests, they start to get quite worried about that. And despite the fact that you might make submissions about, you know, all types of sort of property rights and interests under the Transfer of Land Act or the Property Law Act or whatever, Sale of Land Act, in relation to a particular proprietary interest, it may well be that at the end of the day the members get a bit worried about that consideration and focus principally on the planning issues. Now you'll see as I go through my talk where the kind of pressure points, shall we say, are going to be in that consideration, but it's a tactically, when you're sitting down at the start of getting some instructions where this person's saying, look, you know, I want to develop this land, but I've got this restrictive covenant that says I can only have one house on the lot. That's one of the considerations you need to have about going to VCAT. Obviously, Rupert will talk about the issues in relation to going to the Supreme Court, but that's certainly something you need to bear in the back of your mind. Now, just very briefly on the Subdivision Act side of things. Section 36 in the Subdivision Act allows you to remove or vary restrictions, and as I said before, you'll end up in either the Real Property Act, the Real Property List, or the Owners Corporation List, if you're not going to characterise it as a planning permit or a planning amendment. The Planning and Environment Act has a series of effectively parallel provisions with the Subdivision Act. That allow a person to apply for a planning permit to the local council to create, vary or remove a restriction, to vary or remove conditions in the nature of easements in Crown grants, and create or remove easements or rights of way under the Subdivision Act. So it's pretty broad scope available under the Planning Act to do that, in conjunction with some provisions in the planning scheme in Victoria that allow those sorts of applications to be made. Now, as I said, you go to the council first, more often than not, because there's a restrictive covenant or some kind of proprietary interest involved, it'll be refused, and you then have to go off to VCAT to have a decision made. And I'm just going to focus on that process. So, you've made the strategic decision that you want to go to VCAT, the council, and apply for a planning permit to vary your restriction. Apart from the other application documents that you need to include, when there's a restriction involved, you also need to include copies of the restriction with the initial application, and you've got to identify all the allotments that benefit from that restriction. Now, that might sound pretty straightforward, but all you do is you get the copy of the title, do a title search, and you get the plan of subdivision attached to that. But often you need to consider forensically what's been going on around the area where the subject land is located, because if a restrictive covenant has been sitting around for, in some cases, 100 years, there might be other plans of subdivision which have that beneficial interest applying to it as well too. So My advice there is don't just automatically assume that the plan of subdivision attaching to certificate of title is necessarily all the information that you need to provide to the council or indeed to VCAT later on. Got to be a little bit more forensic than that, I think. Now, there's no need when you apply to the council to also have a planning application as well too. So using my example again of the, you know, one house on a lot, an application to say bowl it over and build three townhouses on there. But I have to say it's probably better if you do. I've done cases where the person simply wants to remove the restrictive covenant because they're not sure what they want to do with the land, and other people are saying, no, this is definitely what I want to do and I want to see if I can get it through. And because of what I've said before about the tribunal being far happier dealing with planning issues rather than property ones, if there's an application in there as well too, as part of what, if there's an application to redevelop the land as part of the overall application, you're generally speaking going to have more luck. Now, the Act provides that when the council is considering the initial application, it can't grant a permit unless it's satisfied that the owner of the land, that the owner of any land benefited by the restriction will be unlikely to suffer the following things: financial loss, loss of amenity, loss arising from a change to the character of the neighbourhood, or any other material detriment. So you might think, oh, geez, I don't know how we're going to cover all of those things off, but what I think is important to try and remember is that if you can identify who the beneficial owners of the land, the beneficial owners of the restriction are, to contact them before and see if you can't get some written consent to the activity. And that will obviate the council having to consider any of those things, because if you can say, look, there are four beneficial owners nearby, they've all consented, it should be a matter of just ticking that box off and moving on. In addition to those provisions, there's a further provision, Clause 65 of the Planning and Environment Act, that provides the following. The responsible authority must not grant a permit which allows the removal or variation of restriction unless it's satisfied that the owner of any land benefited by the restriction will be unlikely to suffer any detriment of any kind, including a perceived detriment, as a consequence of the removal or variation of the restriction. And if the owner has objected to the grant of the permit, the objection is vexatious on the land in good faith. Now, given those couple of final provisions, in most circumstances, if there's any objection to it by a beneficial owner, the council will just simply refuse the application, and you then have to apply to VCAT for a review. So let's look at this concept of detriment. The tribunal has noted in some cases that the test imposed by that provision of the Act is so high and strict that it severely restricts the ability of the tribunal to modify a covenant. Now, that might be true, but a number of other cases have obviously permitted variations and removals to be made. And in one case, there were five considerations that the tribunal had, which seems to be the pattern that a lot of them follow now in more recent cases. The tribunal's got to determine whether it's satisfied on the balance of probabilities that any covenant beneficiary will be unlikely to suffer any detriment of any kind if the variation is committed. In other words, it's not a question of whether the tribunal be satisfied there will be detriment. The tribunal must be affirmatively satisfied that there will be none. Compliance with planning controls does not of itself and without more establish that a covenant beneficiary will be unlikely to suffer any detriment of any kind. I'm sorry to have to read this out, but it sort of makes sense once we discuss it a bit later. Consideration of a proposal from a planning perspective often requires a balancing of competing interests. There's no such balancing exercise involved in the consideration of the issue which arises under the first paragraph. The nature of the inquiry is fundamentally different. So what they're saying is, well, do the beneficiaries, do the beneficial parties with beneficial interest have they identified any potential objection that relates to a detriment to them? And really, that's the only consideration you need to have. The mere assertion of the existence of a detriment, however, is not sufficient to demonstrate its existence. On the other hand, loss of amenity will constitute a detriment, and in this regard, amenity includes an appeal to aesthetic judgment, which is difficult to measure. However, the notion of perceived detriment specifically contemplates that this consideration is relevant to the inquiry. So what the tribunal is saying there is, well, there's this whole concept of detriment that you have to consider, and it could well be an amenity issue like noise or traffic or parking or overshadowing or whatever, the usual kinds of planning considerations. But when you're thinking about whether or not that amenity is likely, it can even be perceived by the person, let alone something that's actual. And the final thing the tribunal says, it's not necessary for an affected person to assert detriment. This is so for two reasons. First, because the tribunal must be affirmatively satisfied of a negative, namely that there will probably be no detriment of any kind. Second, the tribunal is entitled to form its own views from the evidence. And that's where that last comment by the tribunal actually gives you a bit of hope for bringing an application in this jurisdiction. Because they say there's probably going to be no detriment, and it's entitled to form its own view from the evidence. So, trying to sort of boil down what the tribunal said in those paragraphs I've just read out to you, I think the first question you need to have in your mind is, well, what's the nature of the restriction, and how is this affected by the proposal? Is an objection identified by a beneficial objector to the proposal likely or unlikely to occur? If it's likely, is it a detriment? That is a claim of detriment a mere assertion, or does it relate to more substantive amenity issue? Again, are the objectors vexatious or not made in good faith? Does the proposal otherwise comply with the scheme? And what evidence is before the tribunal of the appeal site and its environs? Now, before coming back to some of those issues a bit later, the first thing that you need to look at, obviously, is, well, what does the restriction say? Are we dealing with a case, for example, where it's one house per lot, or are we dealing with a use-type restriction, like can't use it for a brothel or something, or is it a nature of a restriction where it's to do with only using particular types of building materials and having the house set back a certain distance from the road? You've got to characterise what the restriction is. And then you need to see, well, how does the proposal fit with that? Does it require the total removal of the restriction, or is the application merely to try and just vary a few words in it? Sometimes these restrictions go for 2 or 3 pages and include all kinds of weird and wonderful requirements, many of which are anachronistic now. But there might be, in addition to the restriction on one house per lot, also a whole lot of restrictions about what kind of building materials can be used. Now, obviously, if you want to develop the subject land with 3 townhouses, for example, all you want to change is the restriction about 1 unit per lot. And what you then need to ensure is that the rest of the application otherwise satisfies the terms of the restrictive covenant. And the reason you try and do that is because if you want complete removal of the restriction, then you have to deal with every possible detriment of every possible development enabled by its removal, rather than just dealing with the restriction is of 1 unit per lot, 3 townhouses. That's the argument. The next step that you need to do is you've obviously got to characterise any objection that comes in as relating to the particular restriction. So what you have to do is you have to break out the objections. For example, if the application is to redevelop as 3 townhouses, all the objections about noise and whatever, to an extent, need to be put to one side and related back to the restriction about one unit per lot. Because somebody might say, look, there's going to be a lot more amenity impact because there are now going to be three townhouses on this land rather than one house. But it's also fair to say, well, I could redevelop the house as, you know, a rooming house or something like that, and have the same amenity impact. So you've got to just go through that exercise, and it may well be that, look, you can't really distinguish between the objections that have been made and the restriction, or that the restriction relates to all the amenity issues that have been raised, but you've nonetheless got to go through the exercise because you might be able to knock a few out. It's certainly relevant to the tribunal if there's been significant redevelopment in the area, because that then puts the proposal that you want to undertake into some form of context. So, for example, if the neighbouring blocks on either side to your site were once single dwelling houses and are now have now been redeveloped as three townhouses, you basically want to do the same thing. Well, that's a far different situation to one where there's single houses on either side and you're the first person to move. That sort of development should inform the tribunal as to whether there's a real chance or possibility that a detriment will result from the removal or variation of the restriction. So if you can say, well, look, we're doing no more than what's been going on in the area anyway, in those circumstances, you should take that into account in consideration. Now, I mentioned before about what a vexatious objection is, and it might be sometimes that you can characterise an objector's objection as being vexatious. Because it's slightly different to what you would think of as being as frivolous and vexatious. In one tribunal case, there's quite an interesting way of explaining what I mean by all of this. The tribunal said, I don't mean that an objection are made in good faith in the sense of being dishonest. I do not mean that they are vexatious in the sense of being raised to annoy or embarrass the applicant or anyone else. They may amount to a very weak case against the proposal, but I do not need to decide whether they are vexatious in the sense of being so unarguable as to be utterly hopeless. I am satisfied that they are vexatious in the sense that they are designed to achieve an ulterior purpose. Objections by the owners could benefit, but designed not to uphold the covenant and its purpose in terms of urban design, but to seek to achieve the defeat of the development proposal for reasons unrelated to the covenant, and because the objectors do not like the proposal for such other reasons. Now, obviously, that was a decision on its facts, but, excuse me. But you do need to look at whether or not an objection is vexatious in some way to see whether or not that's a basis for arguing that that they should be discounted by the tribunal. The trouble you have with that, though, is that possible detriments referred to in an objection may well be weak or unlikely, but they may nevertheless be arguable. Possible, and so not obviously untenable or groundless or hopeless. The tribunal did give us a bit of help recently in a case where they said, look, the general rule of thumb has been that an objecting beneficiary typically needs to be located in a different street from the application to have a good case that the section can still be satisfied. So what they're saying there is you've got to also consider where the objections are coming from. If they're coming from immediate neighbours, that's one thing, but if there's somebody from down the street or around the corner who may well have the beneficial interest, well, there's scope to discount what they have to say in those circumstances. So that's actually quite a good, that's quite a sensible thing to say, I think. It does indicate to you as well the propensity of the tribunal to take a planning consideration of an issue rather than a strictly proprietary one. Because you would think that anybody who has the beneficial interest in the land from a proprietary interest can say whatever they like about the restriction not being removed, and you would have to give it a similar weight. But given that the tribunal has a sort of more planning approach to these things, that's not necessarily going to be the case. So while you have to go through the process of seeing whether you can characterise any of the objectors' objections as being vexatious, probably at the end of the day you'd be better off leaving that one alone, given that the test is fairly high. So for some pointers that I've given you there, you might do yourself more harm than good by arguing with PCAT, but you obviously have to go through the process of considering it. Now obviously, I'm probably going back a bit here, but when you're looking at the restriction and what it provides, they sometimes say the same thing three or four different times within the terms of the restriction. So the one dwelling per lot example could well be expressed three or four different times throughout the context of the restriction that might often go on for three or four pages. And it's possible in those circumstances that you can play with that, and it might give you some opening to say, well, actually, the first time it says no house, but the second time it says maybe no house, and the third time it says no house where the following materials are not being used. So it may in fact not say no house, no more than one house per block. You obviously need to examine the words of the restriction very carefully to see whether or not there's any scope to say, well, I'm actually not going to be in breach of it by doing what I want to do here. Now, the approach the tribunal is taking to looking at this issue is to say, well, we'll look at the words in a colloquial, non-technical sense, which is what they seem to do with pretty much everything down there, look at it in a colloquial, non-technical sense. But certainly slight changes in the wording used or in the order in which the words are used can have a significant effect on the meaning of a phrase or similar phrases in a covenant. The obvious is to discover the intention of the parties as revealed by the language they have used in the document in question, and that's obviously the parties who entered into the restrictive covenant in the first place. For example, a covenant may restrict the use rather than works, or not restrict the number of residents on the land, nor the number of vehicles or traffic associated with one dwelling. In which case, it's able, I think, to submit to the tribunal, well, given this restrictive covenant doesn't talk about those things, you've got to possibly discount the person's objection on those grounds. Now, obviously, the test that needs to be satisfied under the Act is a very high one. You've got to carefully examine the language of the easement, of the restriction, and identify which activities are restricted by the covenant. And that therefore may affect the basis on which you bring an application. There's a much higher likelihood of success when application 36 to vary as opposed to remove the restriction, and the application is made in the context of an overall redevelopment proposal for the land. It's fair to say, I think, that any claim of detriment must be likely to occur and relate to the operation of the covenant. And if you can say, oh, look, it's pretty unlikely that something like that would happen, even if the person's perceiving it's going to be a great issue, you might get some traction with the tribunal saying that sort of thing. If the covenant does not provide protection from an activity, that will be a relevant consideration for the tribunal. So you, in any of these applications, constantly wanting to try and limit the scope of what it is that the covenant provides, and therefore the scope of the argument that you're making, and hopefully increase your chances of success. And finally, identifying the environs around the subject land in the context in which the proposal is situated may assist in your argument. I think finally would say, and you really do need to make sure that your proposal otherwise complies with the planning scheme. Okay, there you go, there's applying for removing a easement or restrictive covenant in VCAT in a nutshell. As I said, my paper will be available at the end, and I think we're intending to have a short break now, and then we'll talk about how you go about it in the Supreme Court. Thanks very much.